Help us, O God, to become masters of ourselves so that we might become the servants of others. Take our lips and speak through them. Take our minds and think through them. Take our hands and work through them. And take our hearts and set them on fire for your love's sake. Amen. Please be seated. My text for this morning are the 27th through 29th verses of the 11th chapter of the book of Numbers. And a young man ran and told Moses, "Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp." And Joshua, son of Nun, the assistant of Moses, one of his chosen men, said, "My lord Moses, stop them." But Moses said to him, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them." Being a campus preacher can be a particularly challenging task. How does one manage to take these archaic and foreign texts and make them relevant for campus life? There are times when a preacher really has to dig deep and get creative to draw direct parallels to our contemporary student life. Which is why I smiled when I first read this morning's lesson from Numbers, which Val read so beautifully for us this morning. For a campus preacher, these verses are like manna from heaven, scriptural pun intended. There's almost too much for me to choose from. There's the complaints of the Israelites, the rabble, or the riffraff, according to the New International Version of the text, who pine for the good old days in Egypt when they had plenty of wonderful culinary options readily available. Meat, fish, melons, and cucumbers. Now there is only manna to look at. They can't even bring themselves to eat it. Looking is as much as they can manage. When you take into account the description of manna as being like coriander seed, and its color was like the color of gum resin, it's not hard to empathize with the Israelites. A month into the school year, one can imagine things like vegetarian taco crumbles as the manna of the Harvard dining halls. And one can almost hear the plaintive cry, "If only we had red spice chicken to eat." Then there's the issue of leadership. There's an almost insatiable hunger for leadership development on a campus that prides itself on breeding successive generations of world leaders. How can I get leadership experience? How many leadership positions can I hold? Who can I get to be my leadership guru? These are the existential questions for students here at Harvard. And here Moses is, arguably the first such guru, delivering a blunt primary lesson on leadership. You don't want it. "Why have you treated your servant so badly?" Moses asks. "Why have I not found favor in your sight, that you may lay the burden of all this people on me? Death is preferable to leadership." That's what Moses has to say to all the aspiring leaders out there. Somehow I suspect that the 11th chapter of Numbers has not found its way into many of the syllabi of Harvard's leadership courses. Thankfully, this is not all that Numbers has to say to our life as a campus community this morning. We are not doomed to wallow in perpetual diet of manna or vegetarian taco crumbles. And we are not left only with the notion of leadership as a condition of intolerable misery. We also have these two curious men, Eldad and Medad. I say that they are curious because we know next to nothing about them. These verses we read this morning are the only ones in the entire Bible in which Eldad and Medad are mentioned. We don't know where they came from or from whom they were descended, which is always important in the scriptural context. We don't know why Eldad and Medad chose not to go out to the tent to join the others. We don't even know what it was that they were prophesying about. Yet in spite of this lack of knowledge, or perhaps because of it, there is something so appealing about Eldad and Medad. It is easy to identify with them as outsiders. an experience many of us have shared at various points in our lives. Many have identified with Eldad and Medad over the years. A preacher in the late 1950s seized upon these two enigmatic prophets as role models for Protestant Christianity, courageous examples of a kind of rugged individualism willing to stand up to the tyranny of religious institutional hierarchy. The lack of available information about Eldad and Medad makes them prime candidates as poster children for just about any number of causes. We don't know anything about Eldad and Medad, but we do know that they were underdogs, and there are few things we love more than an underdog. Just this past week, Harvard historian Jill Lepore published an opinion piece on the New York Times website that explored the notion of the underdog. It turns out that the term is uniquely American, and it dates all the way back to a poem published in 1859 entitled The Underdog in the Fight. According to Lepore, sympathy for the underdog meant sympathy for the downtrodden. But she points out that over the last 50 years, corporations and political candidates have cast themselves as underdogs to capitalize off our sympathetic tendencies. Pretending to be an underdog, she writes, is good business. The good news for the pretenders is that even if their true identity is revealed, the game is not yet over. Professor Lepore cites a 1963 study conducted by professors here at Harvard and at Cornell, which found that, quote, the people who were most sympathetic with underdogs were sympathetic with top dogs too, unquote. Sympathy, she simply states, is sympathy. There's plenty of sympathy to go around in this encounter in the Israelite camp with Eldad and Medad. Just as we sympathize with the unknown underdogs, we can just as easily sympathize with Aaron, the top dog, who we know plenty about. Aaron, the brother of Moses. Aaron, the spokesperson for his brother with the speech impediment. Aaron, who has chosen status even amongst the 70 elders gathered in the tent. We can sympathize with Aaron too, can't we? We can sympathize with Aaron's sense of righteous indignation at seeing these men out amongst the riffraff, acting as if they had been in the tent, surrounded by the Spirit of God. We know what it's like to have our sense of propriety violated. We know what it's like to have our aesthetic sensibilities repudiated. We know it better than we would ever care to admit. And we are not alone. In his book, Upon This Rock, journalist Samuel Friedman catalogs the life of St. Paul Community Baptist Church in New York City and its minister, Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood, in the late 80s and early 90s. Reverend Youngblood was confronted with a significant social challenge to his ministry. There were effectively no men involved in the church. Now, I can already hear the internal voices of some women out there thinking themselves, now where's the problem exactly? In response to this challenge, Reverend Youngblood applied a radical solution. He created a board of elders made up entirely of men. The board was filled quickly and considered a success, but the problem had still not been solved. The board of elders by itself could not accommodate enough men, Friedman writes, and those it excluded might not care to join the choir or become an usher. St. Paul's needed to reach out to men who could not imagine a place for themselves in the church. So what did Reverend Youngblood do? He turned to the 11th chapter of Numbers and created a new men's group that he named Eldad Medad. The women who had once run the church became suspicious as more and more men came to attend these secretive Tuesday night discussions. They wanted to know more, and when information proved to be less than forthcoming, some came to respond, well, then we're just going to have a group of our own, Elmam Mimam. The women of St. Paul Community Baptist Church had cycled through both sides of the continuum. As outsiders in the broader society, they had managed to achieve status and respect in the church. Through the church, they had been able to use their God-given talents. In the process, they had become the chosen ones. They had become elders. And when that order became threatened, they responded much like Aaron, out of a sense of righteous indignation and of fear. Many of us fight a constant battle between our competing sympathies. We may want to see ourselves as the plucky prophets out amongst the riffraff. At the same time, deep down, we're afraid to admit that we're more likely the indignant elder sequestered in the tent. Many of us here at Harvard struggle with complex identities that toggle between these two poles. On this campus, we may see ourselves as outsiders, far outside the tent. While outside the gates, we are perceived to be amongst the chosen few. It can be hard to know where we stand in the continuum between Aaron on one hand and Eldad and Medad on the other. No matter how complex our identities may be, there is a hard truth that we all must face this morning. We are all tent dwellers. Nearly every one of us enjoys the status of being chosen in one way or another. We are gathered, in fact, right here and now as a community in a tent, a well-built tent, an ornate tent, a beautiful tent, but a tent nonetheless. It would be easy for us to congratulate ourselves for being here in this tent. It would be easy for us to leave this tent today with an inflated sense of piety and righteousness, to see ourselves as morally superior to those who slept in, read the A section of the Sunday Times front to back, and are presently halfway through the crossword. You may be jealous of them right now, in fact. After service, we may sit down for brunch with some tussle-headed folks in the dining halls, eager to talk about the meaning of life, and think to ourselves, who are you to talk about meaning? You couldn't even get yourself out of bed before noon. When we leave this tent in a few minutes and spill out into the yard, we will still be amidst one of the most elite tents of the world as members of the Harvard community. As we venture out of the Harvard bubble, perhaps when we head home for the holidays and encounter people willing to share their ideas for how to solve the world's most intractable problems, we might think to ourselves, who are you to think that you can solve this? Our professors at Harvard can't even figure it out. Who are you to? That is the question that pops into Aaron's head when he hears about Eldad and Medad. And it has been the question asked by tent dwellers over the millennia. Who are you to is a question that is based on a concept that Reverend Ed Bacon, the rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California, refers to as the myth of scarcity. Ed elegantly discusses the myth of scarcity in his new book, Eight Habits of Love. In a chapter devoted to the practice of generosity, he writes that it, quote, it is often challenging for people to practice generosity because they are hampered by the notion that they need more for themselves. Whether it is more money, more acclaim, more attention, more patience, or more love. They see their capacities as finite. In some ways, this is, of course, true, but in some ways, it is patently untrue. Unquote. It is true that there is scarcity in the world. We are all too aware of this fact. Just as there are only 70 spots in the tent out in the wilderness, there are only 1,600 available spaces for incoming freshmen at Harvard College each year. When you consider that more than 34,000 students applied to be a member of the class of 2016, it's hard to argue that scarcity is not a reality. But reality is not what drives the myth of scarcity. Ed Bacon writes that, quote, "This feeling flows directly from the force field of fear. I must hoard. I must grasp. I simply do not have enough even to give a little bit away. I am depleted." Sound familiar? Once we have obtained something that is scarce, we immediately fear that we will lose it. We fear that we have obtained, that what we have obtained will lose its value. We fear that we will be found to be undeserving of the scarce resources we have managed to get our grubby mitts on. Remember that the women of St. Paul's Church in New York, remember that they became suspicious once the men were given special status. Their suspicion was predicated on the fear that there was only so much status, so much respect to go around. And they weren't about to go back to the bad old days. Despite their protests, they would rather be Aaron than Elmom or Mimom. Ours is a community that is plagued by fear. We live in a near constant state of fear. Fear of failure, fear of not having it all figured out. Fear that others' success will devalue our own prestige. And even more commonly, fear that we will ultimately be found unworthy of the Harvard name, a fraud. And because of our fear, we Harvard types grasp onto our status with white-knuckled determination. We can find some relief in the fact that we are not the only community to live in a state of fear and anxiety, and we are certainly not the first. The Israelites, in fact, offer an ancient example for what it is to be an elite, chosen people. The book of Numbers itself is something of a travel diary, recording how the Israelites dealt with fear as they wandered for 40 years out in the wilderness. When we encounter the Israelites this morning, they are struggling with the reality that the safety and security of their known world is gone. Their homes are gone. The food they loved is gone. They lash out against Moses and against God as a people consumed by fear. God's response, however, is revealing. The calling of the 70 elders into the tent demonstrates God's awareness of the reptilian, fight-or-flight side of our all-too-human brains. The conferring of status on the elders appealed to their survival instincts. It corresponded with their rational notion that security is not guaranteed, but scarce. The tent provides them with the easy security of external validation. God had chosen them. But God does a curious thing. The elders are not the only ones who receive the gift of prophecy. Eldad and Medad out there with the riffraff are granted the very same gift. Aaron, as we know, is incensed. But Moses has a very different reaction. Would that all the Lord's people were prophets. Moses recognizes that the myth of scarcity is the problem. In his own prophetic mind, he knows what his community could be if only it would let go of its vice grip on fear. As the only prophet to speak directly to God, Moses has access to the most fundamental truths about God, over and above any of the noble prophets who would follow in his footsteps. And here Moses speaks a truth that Ed Bacon and countless others have picked up for thousands of years, that with God's love and generosity, there is no such thing as scarcity, only abundance. God's love, God's gifts, God's blessings are too great to be contained in any tent, not a tent in the wilderness, and not this tent of brick and mortar we find ourselves in this morning. That truth is meant to be a wake-up call to us as tent dwellers. We cannot allow ourselves to be lulled into a false sense of security, a sense of security that is built on scarcity and ultimately on fear. The more that we give in to fear, the smaller our tent becomes, and the more we are cut off from the life-giving abundance that is God's love. God is calling us out of our tents, out in search of others who may not enjoy the status that we experience as Harvardians and people of Memorial Church. We can experience true security when we let go of our self-serving pursuit of status and instead seek to serve others, especially those who do not feel welcome, those who are afraid, those who were never invited in the first place. We experience the fullness of God's abundance when we allow ourselves to become agents of God's love. That is why I find the prayer that I recited before starting this sermon to be so powerful. It reminds us that our purpose as people of faith is to find a way to master ourselves so that we might ultimately become servants of others. God is calling us to become agents of abundant love rather than misers of fearful scarcity. It is up to us to trust that we need not cling to the security of our tents in order to survive. We must be willing to take a risk, to let go of our need to hoard all that we have in order to open ourselves to God's radical and expansive love. Our life of faith calls upon us to let go of the things we grasp the tightest in order to experience that which we yearn for in the deepest depths of our being, God's love. So before we leave this tent, let me ask, how big is your tent? What limits do you set on who belongs in your life, on who is worthy of your time and energy, on who can contribute to your communities? Who do you dismiss with the question, who is she to? Whatever the answers to those questions are, wherever our tent poles are staked, God is calling us to a life of service that pushes our poles, our nation's poles, our university's poles, and our church's poles ever wider. And when we feel like there's not enough room to fit one more person inside the tent, then it's time to go out in search of Eldad and Medad, who will remind us that with God, there is no such thing as not enough. Amen.